Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We have so much change going around in the NFL right now. New quarterbacks, new offenses, but mostly new quarterbacks. We're going to talk about a lot of it on this show, Andy.
New quarterbacks has been a theme this year, and I feel like we'll dive into it more, but off the top of my head, surface level, I think a lot of them are playing pretty well.
I agree with that. I think most quarterbacks in the league are playing pretty well.
It's a quarterback-friendly league, yes. But I guess when you have a backup quarterback come in, what's always interesting, you have to see how they play, but also how the team attempts to play with them. What are those guys asked to do? And we talked about Mason Rudolph last week in Pittsburgh and how when he came in the second half of that game, and I have not seen the Niners film yet from Pittsburgh, but in week two in the second half when he came in, the offense accidentally got more complex schematically, or at least a little bit sharper schematically. I thought there were a few other teams that were starting to see that, mainly in Carolina, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Kyle Allen in a minute here. We're also going to talk, of course, about Daniel Jones, but we're going to start the Deep Dive Podcast with Cowboys-Saints, big Sunday night matchup. And look, we just saw the Saints, even without Drew Brees, they just went to Seattle and won a game pretty handily. So this is still a very formidable team, but to me, the story of the first month of the season, at least on the field, has been this Cowboys offense and what they're doing differently. And I guess the question now is, how sustainable is it going forward?
Well, what they're doing differently, it's a lot more schematic input. So the Cowboys for a lot of years have been a spread offense, ISO routes, pretty basic. And we should be clear, Scott Linehan had a great career in the early 2000s running similar type of offenses with the Vikings. I think he's with the Rams for a while and had success there. It's not the same NFL now, though. So Kellen Moore has really overhauled the offense, quite frankly, and there's a lot of motion now. The routes intertwine and they relate to one another. The run game is a little bit more diverse. It's been a pretty good run game in Dallas over the years. Long story short, though, it's a more defined offense. The plays have very specific intentions built into them. Dak Prescott has responded really well, Gary, and it's absolutely sustainable because the scheme asks both more and less of its players. It asks more in the sense that you're doing more things and you're lining up in more ways, but the benefit of that is the plays give you more answers and more defined answers versus the isolation routes where a quarterback really has to read a lot of the field and make plays in and of himself, and that can be challenging for any quarterback.
Yeah, it's wild. A month ago, we were wondering how they could possibly go into the season without Ezekiel Elliott and the foundation of that ground game that they rely on so heavily. And now all of a sudden, the ground game is almost a complementary piece here. I mean, it's chugging along fine, but it's certainly not the headliner of this offense anymore.
And what's also been cool is the offense has changed its identity a little bit each week to fit the opponent. They faced the Giants in week one. The Giants do a lot of things. Matchup coverage is inherent with New York. And the more you do, the more likely it is that you play matchup rather than zone coverage. That's kind of a rule of thumb. And the Giants are a defense that does a lot of things. They match up. So the Cowboys, they fought fire with fire. They did a lot of things. They tried to make the Giants reactive, and we saw everything you could imagine from Dallas, including a lot of jet motion and orbit motion with Tavon Austin. Austin was out in week two. Washington, that's Dallas's opponent. They're a little bit more basic defensively, and Dallas kind of went back to some of the stuff they'd been doing under Linehan, spreading out because they wanted to spread out Washington and isolate those basic coverages. They still did the new stuff, but it was a very different game plan. And then against Miami, we saw the Cowboys take advantage of some of the man coverages that Miami played early on. Another game plan tailored for that matchup. They ran the ball very well there. So it's been something else every single week so far.
And what are they going to see with the Saints defense? The Saints offensively have played well this year. You know, we saw it. It got away from them a little bit against the Rams. So that was also, a lot of that was sort of being on the field a lot in the second half of that game after Brees went down. Last week, they got the better of the Seahawks. The Seahawks had three fourth quarter long touchdown drives to kind of skew the numbers here, including a touchdown as time expired to cut the lead to six. So the numbers alone don't really tell the story of how well the Saints played defensively in Seattle last week.
I think the Saints are at their best when their secondary is playing fast and active football. And the faster and more, I hate to say something flimsy, but the more energetic the secondary looks, typically the better the Saints are playing. They don't do a lot of complex things. Once you snap the ball, you often know what you're looking at with the Saints defense, but you're not going to know what you're looking at necessarily until you snap the ball. And you can't base what you're seeing off of other snaps because they change it from snap to snap. So it's a steadily changing defense with a lot of routine coverages. And so you get the best of both worlds in their coordinator Dennis Allen's mind. You are playing basic stuff so your guys can play fast, but you're not at all predictable because you're constantly changing it up.
I mean, so you figure they'd put Marshawn Lattimore on Amari Cooper seems kind of an obvious way to go. Maybe they put Lattimore elsewhere and do the double team on Cooper. But I guess that's one question I kind of have about the Cowboys right now, especially with Michael Gallup has been banged up. Do they have the necessary depth in that receiving core weaponry, especially when you consider, I mean, Jason Witten's been a nice addition. He's not quite what he was. You could say something similar for Randall Cobb, who kind of came back to earth after that really good week one. But if you can take Amari Cooper out of this game, or at least limit him, how problematic is that for the Cowboys here?
Not as problematic as it would have been a year ago. That's the benefit of running a more complex or intricate scheme, is you can still scheme guys open. A great example was Devin Smith in week two on the long touchdown that he had against Josh Norman. And Norman got beat on that play. Norman's not having the greatest start to a season this year, but it was It was also Norman was out-leveraged by the coverage and the route concept as well. And so it's a little bit of scheme helping player. And when you do that, you often isolate the best traits of that player. Devin Smith, for when he was on the field with the Jets, which was not often, he was a vertical weapon. So you're seeing the player, you can still find what your players do well. So I don't think it's, I mean, if Cooper, let's say Cooper has three catches for 29 yards in this game, that certainly hurts Dallas's chances, but I don't think that by any means sinks them per se. And remember, they can still run the ball as well. New Orleans' run defense last year was one of the very best in the NFL. I think it ranked first or second statistic. It was right up there on film, I know. They haven't been quite the same run defense this season in the big picture, but that's probably where this game comes down to, Gary, is who runs the ball effectively. Well, I might take that back because the Saints don't have Drew Brees, so you don't need to keep their offense off the field the same way, maybe.
Yeah, it's almost like we didn't really get a read on the Saints last week. That game was a little bit unique how it started. They got a punt return early. They then got a fumble return touchdown midway through the second quarter, and a big Alvin Kamara play later. The game was kind of starting to get out of reach. So we had kind of wondered, okay, are we going to see a bunch of Taysom Hill packages or something like that? It's almost like they didn't have to go to that because the Saints were basically playing with a lead almost throughout in Seattle last week. The game was tied at the end of the first quarter, but they didn't. I guess they didn't have to empty their bag of tricks in any way, shape, or form.
They probably will this week. Dallas, you know what you're getting with Dallas. They don't disguise a whole lot, and they play extremely fast. What concerns me, because anyone that's heard our podcast knows, I don't know if you share this thought with me, Gary, but you know that I feel that Teddy Bridgewater has limitations and he's not going to pull the trigger on some open throws. That's, to me, that's inevitable. Yeah. Dallas is
so, that's totally fair.
Okay, you feel that. So Dallas is so fast on the back end, and their linebackers can cover so much area. And Van Der Esch this year has gotten a really good feel for his zone drops and where he's locating. That's a big deal because so much of the Saints' offense is about attacking at those intermediate levels through the air inside. So attacking the linebacker area, the safety area. That's a hard spot to go after the Cowboys, and everywhere's hard. That's a fast, talented defense that doesn't get talked about. But if you have a cautious quarterback, that's not the kind of defense you want him going up against.
I mean, does it make sense? Let's say it was a heavy dose of Taysom Hill and sort of read option type misdirection stuff this week. Does it make sense that could be effective against what's a really fast-flowing Cowboys defense?
That's a great question. There were people last year in the league that felt that you could use that effectively against Dallas, but it was more in the north and south fakes. So basically play action, because Jalen Smith and Van Der Esch, they really hit it hard when they hit their run gaps. As far as moving laterally, they're both so good and fast moving left and right, which is really what you're trying to exploit when you're running the Taysom Hill type of stuff, or you're isolating an unblocked defensive end, in this case probably DeMarcus Lawrence, and running off of that. It's a little bit of a different type of misdirection offense. I think if you want to really go after Dallas, you want to use their speed to punish them. Read options are inherently slow developing plays. Quicker play action is how you use the speed to punish the guys. But again, that gets back to the quarterback has to then pull the trigger on those.
Yeah, this will be a real good one Sunday night. I know everyone's a little bit disappointed to see the Saints go out there without Breeze. When the Cowboys beat them last year on a Thursday night in Dallas, that was a game that there was no Taysom Hill in that game. So it was a pretty traditional Saints offense that they really matched up with and just really shut down in that game. That was a 13-10 Cowboys win, a game that they led throughout. So it'll be a good one Sunday night.
It will, but let's also just be honest, and this is a game Dallas should win, because what you just said, oh, there's no Taysom Hill last time, what can they do with Taysom Hill this time? Taysom Hill's a nice player. He does a lot of things pretty well. I don't think he does anything great, but he's good at a lot of things. He's a high-end backup utility player. In what world do we live where if we're talking about the impact of the high-end backup utility player? Oh, is he playing or not? Was he in last time? You know, this is a game Dallas should win.
This world is where we live now, Andy. Yeah. The world of the Teddy Bridgewater Saints.
Yeah.
Nice moment last week for Teddy Bridgewater. Nice win for him. But as we said, we didn't have to see the Saints offense do a whole lot of lifting due to some of the special teams and defensive touchdowns early. But let's go on to a guy who did do a lot of lifting last week for his offense. That is Daniel Jones. Giants at Redskins. This will be start number two for Daniel Jones. I'll handing it off to someone for the guitar solo. I'll just let you go, Andy. What do you think of Daniel Jones?
Well, you called me last night to ask me to watch the Giants film before we did the show, which you don't normally do that. So, and you said in that request, kind of leading the witness a little bit here, but you said to me, I think you're going to like it. Why did you think I was going to like the film?
Two things. How long he hung in the pocket. If anything, my biggest criticism of him was he's in there too long and a little too careless with the ball at times. I think that was his biggest problem. But I mean, he is back there forever. And then I was really surprised with the arm talent. And look, he's not Patrick Mahomes. He's not, there are no throws of him, just absolutely firing something. But those muddy pockets, he made so many throws from muddy pockets or throws while getting hit that really had more than enough zip on him.
Yes.
Not Josh Allen fastballs, but more than enough zip to complete them in an NFL game. And I figured he'd be comfortable with the offense, that Pat Shurmur offense is a good fit for him. I was surprised how much I liked the arm, which, again, it's almost like, do we get spoiled after seeing a Mahomes and a Josh Allen come out the last 2 years, and we sort of lost our sense of what arm strength is for a collegiate prospect? But the arm was much better than I thought it would be, and again, he's back there for so long. The play is alive for so long, and his eyes are upfield throughout the entire play.
I know, I agree with you. It's funny because one of the things I thought is he's very good at getting off of bad reads early. And when the play demanded that he be quick, he would be quick. He'd get to the check down quickly. He didn't have to check down a whole lot in that game, but you could tell he was very efficient getting off the bad reads. And yet, when you say he was in the pocket so long, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I agree with that as well. He played on schedule snap after snap. Whatever the snap demanded of him schedule-wise from the pocket, that's the rate he played. It wasn't too fast. It wasn't too slow. It was right where you want it. I agree. The arm looked better. And the gutsiness in the pocket and the field vision and the way he processed coverages was also very impressive. And I don't think Tampa Bay is a little bit predictable on defense, Gary. They split safety usually means some form of traditional zone for them. Single high means you're getting pressure. And I think Daniel Jones got a feel for that, but the times where they did change it up, Jones reacted seamlessly there as well. It was a very impressive debut, probably graded a 9 out of 10. Ball security in the pocket you talked about. Those tackles have to play better as well. We worried about them coming into the season. And Remmers on the right side has really not been a huge issue. Solder on the left side didn't look like he belonged on the field against Shaq Barrett. That's a problem. Now, he's facing Montez Sweat this week, and Sweat has looked very much like a rookie this season. He had his lunch handed to him by Jason Peters in week one and then Tyrone Smith in week two. He's a little noisier in week three against Chicago, Charles Leno, but Sweat has a lot to learn, so maybe Solder gets on track this week. But that's my concern moving forward, are those offensive tackles. But Daniel Jones, so far, has shown that he can play through that, because I don't know if it'll get much worse than it did on Sunday with the Bucks. Shaq Barrett was overwhelmingly dominant at times.
Now, I was going to say that, and we're going to talk about Shaq Barrett a little bit later in the show, down in the lightning round. You know, Washington has Ryan Kerrigan. Montez Sweat is a physical dynamo, the rookie.
But that doesn't mean anything if you don't know how to use it yet. I mean, he's a workout warrior at this point. His physicality and his athletic traits have not yet translated to the NFL. And look, it's early. He's played 3 games.
Yep. No, that's totally fair. But this Washington defense, are they capable? The cornerback play has not been great this year. We mentioned Josh Norman, but are they capable of throwing a little bit more at Daniel Jones than what we saw the Bucs try to throw at him?
No, I don't think so. The Bucs are a more expansive defense schematically, and I don't know why they play. Predictable is a harsh word, and that's not a word I've really ever associated with their coordinator, Todd Bowles. So let's not get carried away with it, but I don't really know why they took the approach they did against New York. New York does not have great receivers, and they had a rookie quarterback with tackles who are struggling. I don't know why you wouldn't line up and play one-on-one man coverage across the board and throw all these different blitzes at them, but for whatever reason, they didn't do that. Washington, that's not really in their arsenal to play that way. They're more of a read and react type of defense. In fact, they're one of the few defenses, even just philosophically, read and react. Their D tackles play that way on first and second down, two gap type of principles. So I don't think they'll throw the kitchen sink at Daniel Jones.
Let me ask you this, because obviously we have Daniel Jones on one side of the ball here. Dwayne Haskins, we don't know what he is at this point. You know, we've seen Keenum in this offense. We've seen some nice moments for this offense over the first 3 weeks. We saw really a sloppy, turnover-laden game against Chicago on Monday night. They're not going anywhere this season. I mean, you know, they're sitting on Trent Williams. They say they're not going to trade him. I don't know what the outcome is to this holdout, but Do you consider making the switch to Haskins at this point, or do you kind of look at this and say, look, we got really not a very good offensive line, something that's been a strength for years. Our receiving core is not very good, even though Terry McLaurin has been I think they've gotten as much out of him as you could have possibly hoped for over the first couple of weeks here. But is this situation too shaky to drop Dwayne Haskins, a one-year starter in college, into it?
Well, what they know in Washington that we don't know is how ready Haskins looks or how close to ready he looks. We can assume he's not ready, because if he were, he'd be in there. So how close to ready is he? And the parts of him that he's showing are not ready, what are they? What are the weaknesses? And then it gets into the philosophy of do you throw him into the deep end of the pool and teach him to swim that way, or do you put a life jacket on him and walk him into the kiddie pool at first? And that's to each his own. That gets down to different guys. More people now are just throwing the guys into the deep end of the pool, and with Jay Gruden, his job security cannot be good. I would imagine they would probably lean that way. But look, Gary, you still have to play the quarterback that gives you the best chance to win. You're 3 games into the season. No team in the history of the NFL has ever been eliminated after 3 games. So I understand why they're taking a step back and keeping the big picture here. And if Keenum's a better option, he's the better option. That's pretty telling, too, if that's the case. Because I don't think Keenum, you were right about him week one, week two. But those turnovers against Chicago were problematic.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, that's a And it looked like he was bringing them back. And then that really strange fourth and inches decision to stick the ball out there on the 20-yard line kind of undid all that goodwill of the second half.
I understand what got through his head on that play. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, like, oh, that's right sentiment, wrong thought. Because it was... I understood how it could go that way, but it probably shouldn't at this stage of his career. He's got to know the rules for picking up a first down.
It's that, yeah, it's that, and I don't know if you want your six-foot quarterback going over the top like that. I guess if he was more careful with the ball, maybe it would have worked out,
well,
and we'd be talking about the genius of it. But
sure, and what I also would wonder, well, here's the problem, though. No matter how careful with the ball you are, you're going to fumble that every time, because the difference on the goal line is the play stops as soon as the ball crosses the goal line. First down, you got to continue. So you're holding the ball out in front of you in the most vulnerable position you possibly can, and there's four or five guys across me with a free shot at it. There's nothing between the ball and them. Fumbles are inevitable there. So it was just a mental mistake. What I'd love to know is how do they teach the QB sneak, if they even teach it at all. I just fast forward those plays on film. They are what they look like, a big mush of guys in the middle of the field. But does Keenum does he go over the line by design, or is that his choice when he gets up there? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll find out one day. But we have some more football to talk about. We got Vikings-Bears preview. We're going to talk some Kyle Allen as the Panthers go to Houston. We'll be back in just a second. The MMQB NFL podcast is brought to you by Movement. Stop what you're doing and look down at your left wrist, because our friends at Movement Watches have got exactly what you're missing. Movement has you covered with tons of quality, clean, and all-around good-looking watches and accessories that we can actually afford and order right from our couch. Do your wrist and wallet a favor. Go check out their minimalist designs that you can have with no risk, because they offer free shipping and returns. With over 2 million watches sold worldwide, Movement has solidified themselves as one of the fastest-growing watch brands out there. They also have tons of sunglasses and offer interchangeable watch straps, so you never run out of options for a new look. Movement watches start at just $95, so you're guaranteed to find something you love and won't break your bank. These guys are truly a ground-up entrepreneur success story. They understand living on a tight budget, because they lived it too, and that's why they wanted to make quality products that are accessible to everyone. They've sold over 2 million watches across more than 160 countries, and their collections are always expanding for you. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmt.com/mmqb. See why Movement keeps growing. Check out their expanding collection. Go to mvmt.com/mmqb and join the movement. We're also brought to you by Legacy Box. Everyone loves to feel the joy and nostalgia of the glory days, and nothing's better than looking at the photos and watching the movies from years ago. But maybe you worry about keeping them preserved. Or, even worse, maybe those old movies are on VHS tapes that you just can't play anymore. That's where Legacy Box comes in. Save your family films and photos from degrading or being lost, and become the family hero by bringing those old memories back in digital form. It's simple. Just send them your Legacy Box filled with old home movies and pictures. They'll do the rest, professionally digitizing your moments onto a thumb drive, digital download, or DVD. Receive all your original recorded moments back, along with perfectly preserved digital copies, and get personalized updates emailed to you every step of the way. There's never been a better time to digitally preserve your memories. Visit LegacyBox.com today to get started. Plus, for a limited time, they're offering our listeners an exclusive discount. Go to LegacyBox.com/save and get 40% off your first order. Go to LegacyBox.com/save and save 40% today. Get started preserving your past. All right, the NFC North. Early on, looking like a very, 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 very good division, as we thought it would be. But this is the two teams that have losses in the division, the Vikings and the Bears. Not a do or die game, but certainly, if you're Chicago, this is a nice one to get, because you've already lost to the Packers at home this year, and the Bears were quite frankly just a much better team at home, as a lot of teams are, than they were on the road last season. But I do want to start with this with Kirk Cousins and the Vikings offense, obviously, you know, we talked about it plenty last December when John DeFilippo was let go and how badly Mike Zimmer wanted to run the ball going forward. And we are seeing that to the extreme with this Vikings offense. If, you know, the one game they trailed in, though, Kirk Cousins did not bring that back. He was not able to deliver in Green Bay. What's your feel on what this offense is through 3 weeks, and what's your feel on what Kirk Cousins is in at the beginning of year two in Minnesota?
Well, we have to be honest. Also, it's not just that Cousins didn't bring him back. He was the reason they were behind in Green Bay. He was horrible in that game. He four turnovers, two of them interceptions after he left, possible touchdowns on the field by not seeing things clearly. And that's kind of the Kirk Cousins story. He's certainly not that kind of QB every week, but he will be some weeks, and you're not ever quite sure which weeks they will be. You have to figure on the road at Chicago, it's more likely to be that Kirk Cousins than it would in other games. But he's very much a complimentary piece. Here's the tricky part for me, Gary, and certainly for the Vikings offensive decision makers. Cousins is a complimentary piece, but he doesn't play a complimentary style of football. He's a late in the pocket gunslinger type of guy. He's a gunslinger mentality more than he is a field distributor or a ball distributing mentality. So you almost ask him to pull some of himself back in order to play the type of offense that you want to play, which then raises the question, is it good to run an offense that requires your quarterback to rein himself in inherently?
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like, Cousins is a different type of... Alex Smith and Kirk Cousins are wildly different players. Alex Smith, you could run a bunch. And Alex, don't turn it over, dink and dunk, and that's going to be fine. They're both average quarterbacks. Cousins is average, but almost through more extreme means. He's going to take chances with the ball, and he's going to succeed with some and fail with others. And I think when you see him making good decisions is when he's being proactive. When he has that aggressive mentality, he can rein it back then. But if you ask him to just start off reining it back and then be aggressive when we need you to, that's putting the horse before the cart before the horse, whatever, you know.
Cart before the horse.
Yeah, because the horse in front of the cart, that'd be just fine. The horse could pull the cart. But if the cart's in front of the horse, you've got a problem.
That is. That's the old saying. Yeah, it's he nets out, and that's where people always get sort of crossed up with this. He nets out to an average QB over his sort of lifespan and career here, because the highs and the lows net out, as opposed to a guy like Alex Smith, who's just sort of a steady average play, you know, not necessarily a guy who's gonna bring you behind from behind if you need it. I mean, look, there have been, I still remember Cousins 2 years ago, that last year in Washington, when they went up to Seattle with a bunch of street free agents on the offensive line and Josh Doctson as their leading receiver, and he brought him back and he won that game. And I guess that's what you can get if you end up in a situation when you need it, and most teams at some point in the season do need it. This one figures to be, the Bears got going a little bit offensively. It was not the boldest of passing schemes. It was some neat stuff, some smoke and mirrors, some misdirection, lots of shallow crossers that they used Monday night to win in Washington and to sort of extend that lead early. And then you had, Trubisky did deliver his one nice throw weekly when he hit Taylor Gabriel over the top on that touchdown late in the first half. But it's still a Bears offense that looks like, I mean, they just, they don't want to put Trubisky in a position to basically give the game away.
Yeah, that's probably fair. And by the way, Gary, I it's not impacting our podcast, but you can see on our Skype here that I've gone very blurry. I look like when someone does an interview and I'm exposing like like an inside crime job or something. Like you're protecting my identity here in this podcast.
You are a whistleblower who's about to expose the Bears offense.
Absolutely,
is what this looks like.
The Bears offense gets if we can cut to the chase, at the heart of the problem. It's the same thing that's at the heart of the problem in Carolina, and that is the quarterback can't consistently put the ball where he wants to put the ball. He misses on some throws. And we can talk all we want about all these other attributes and how you scheme it. All of that's great, but none of it is relevant if the quarterback can't put the ball where he wants. That is a requisite for playing offense. Your designs are only as good as the ball location that executes them. That's the problem. I don't know if that goes away at this point. Cam Newton and Mitchell Trubisky both have issues with reading the field and decision making at times. You can coach that out of a guy. What you can't coach out of a guy is accuracy or consistency in accuracy.
Well, I mean, he had a lot of easy throws presented to him in the Washington game. Does he get this against the Vikings? Because he did. If you go back to, I believe it was the Week 17 game that they won in Minnesota, it was meaningless for the Bears. They had already clinched. The Vikings needed it to stay alive. And Trubisky played well in that game. And if I remember correctly, he did not have Allen Robinson. It was sort of a scotch tape together receiving core. And that was... I feel like that was his best moment of the last two seasons here. Because, I mean, I know, look, the first half was fine, and then he goes out there and they try to get him some more easy throws, build up the confidence, and he threw that one goal line fade. I mean, he threw it like I would have thrown it. He threw it about 40% of the distance that it needed to go, and it was the easiest interception you'll see.
I know.
On the goal line.
I rewatched it because I thought maybe it wasn't. I wasn't sure maybe he wasn't throwing a fade, and it was. Yeah, I know what you're talking. Yeah. I don't know what does it matter. At some point, you're still going to need him to throw the ball aggressively, and he can. It's not like he can't do it. He can do it, but it's not going to be steady or consistent. So yeah. then it's a matter of, all right, well, so you this is what you're asking. How do you scheme around that then? I think you need to have a pretty dynamic running game in order to really fully scheme around that. Maybe the Bears have a shot at that. I don't know. I'm still getting a feel for Montgomery, the rookie running back. A lot of people like him. The more, and I understand what they like, is that there's a tenacity to him. He's got that Marion Barber, Marshawn Lynch kind of thing going. I think in today's NFL, you have to make people miss, though. The Tariq Cohens of the world, to me, are a lot more valuable. Like I can't understand why in Denver, Philip Lindsay's splitting time with Royce Freeman, for example. Lindsay, to me, is in a whole other class, and it might be a workload issue there, but we're talking style of back. You give me one play, who do you want? I want Lindsay 10 times out of 10. I want the guy that can create space, and I don't know if Chicago fully has that kind of running game around them, which I think they would need in order to fully play with Trubisky the way you're talking about.
Yeah. The one other thing I wondered on Monday night is they went hurry up early, and they were lining up early in the play clock, and I'm sure that was to get some communication going from the sideline and into Trubisky's ear, and it seemed like an attempt to sort of just help him get as comfortable as humanly possible with what he was seeing before every play. And look, he's a guy, you know, you saw it on the final drive of the playoff game last year. You saw it on the one throw that set up the game-winning field goal in Denver. He's not physically incapable. He just, it looks like he just has absolutely no comfort, no confidence in what he's seeing out there.
Well, we need to understand as well what's being said on those headsets when they do that. I'm still learning this myself, but talking to the coaches that have done that, it's never as much as you think in the headset. Yeah. The coach is not up there saying, all right, Mitch, we're running this play. Now watch the safety, and you might have this over route and then go to the backside dig if the linebacker jumps the over route. It's unlikely that's what Matt Nagy's saying in Trubisky's ear. So they're getting him in and out of the right plays and saying, send him in motion, send him not in motion, whatever it is. But they're not telling him actually what to do on those plays, most likely. I don't know that for certain. But I would imagine they're not telling him what to do there at the snap. So the idea of getting up to the line of scrimmage and checking in out of plays, that gets a little bit overblown for how that helps a QB. Peter King, when he talked to Tom Brady after the Falcons Super Bowl, the big comeback, Brady said, and nobody noticed it at the time, because it's Brady saying this, and it wasn't the hot new coach, but he said, well, yeah, we get to the line of scrimmage quickly because Josh can be in my ear the whole time, Josh McDaniels.
Yep.
So Tom Brady was doing this before Jared Goff was doing this, which tells you it's not a hand-holding gesture necessarily for the quarterback. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Brady was kind of saying it's really just having like a second set of eyes out there.
Absolutely. And look, I'm sure that what McDaniels is saying to Brady is different than what McVay is saying to Goff, or they're doing it for different reasons, but they're not doing it for completely different reasons. At the end of all this, it's still the quarterback on the field playing football and the coach on the sideline calling the game. There's only so much a coach on the sideline can do.
All right. Before we move on, Andy, I just got to say, how about that Dalvin Cook?
Dalvin Cook is tremendous on the perimeter. I think you have to feed him the ball deliberately there 8 to 10 times a game at least. And my guess is that's a conversation the Vikings have had, because they've done a great job of getting him the ball outside early in the game and doing it in a variety of ways.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is just going to be really interesting. I mean, ultimately, you know, this Chuck Pagano defense here in Chicago, can the Vikings move the ball through the ground game against this defense?
I don't know if they can. You certainly can't count on that. And by the way, thank you for not starting this segment with the Chuck Pagano thing, because I probably have to be taken to the woodshed on this, don't I? For the way the Bears are playing defensively, and I said coming in, I don't know if they'll be as good under Chuck Pagano.
You were worried. You weren't hot taking it, though.
I think it got received as hot. No, I agree with you. I was not, but I think it got received as hot taking.
Nah, that doesn't really matter.
My concern was that the Pagano would install a blitz-heavy scheme, and the Bears have been a very zone-based coverage scheme with a lot of nuance, and that's two different things, and I think they're going to be better with what they used to do. Pagano, to his credit, has kind of come back to what they used to do. He's adjusted to them more than he has had the defense adjust to him. And that's, I guess, to some degree, that's on me for not giving him the benefit of the doubt there. I always say coaches coach what they know. Pagano has run some of the split safety stuff, those structures. He played a lot of quarters in Indianapolis. So it's not like he's never played the way Vic Fangio played. I don't think anyone quite plays that way, though. But he's done a really good job of adjusting to this defense so far. Now, I will also say, in the second half against Denver and then throughout the whole game Monday night, he did start dialing up the blitzes. And they were working really well. Buster Screen's been an excellent blitzer for them. Mm-hmm. But that was the defense I thought they would be running that I'm not sure would work in the long haul. It's worked so far, but they have not been challenged by a receiving core yet either. Denver doesn't have any receivers other than Sanders. They don't have anyone that you really fear. Washington, I know McLaurin's playing well, but Washington does not have a receiving core that you fear. The Vikings have two guys that you fear, so you know maybe it's a little bit different this week. I bet if I'm Minnesota, what I do at some point early in the game, and maybe I wait for Pagano to start blitzing before I do it, but I'm going outside deep with Diggs or Thielen and challenging. I got to find a way to challenge those Bears corners one-on-one, because I still think that's your best shot against this team. And right now, both those corners are playing great. That's still your best shot against them.
All right, let's go down to Houston. We got Panthers, Texans, Kyle Allen, start number two. What do you think of Kyle Allen I guess it would have been his second career start, but no one really gave much thought to that Week 17 victory in New Orleans last year. That was meaningless for both teams, but he was sharp, and the offense certainly looked better last week in Arizona.
Absolutely, it looked better not just than it has this season, but than it has in quite a while. He's accurate. He plays on schedule. That makes him different than the starter. Is he more talented than Cam Newton? Of course not. Not even close. But he plays more. Through one game, he played more proficiently in that game than Newton has played in a long, long time. And to me, this gets to become a very interesting conversation if Allen does that for two or three more weeks, Gary.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think they do down in Houston? You got a team that is not very good on the back end, but certainly very good up front. Do the Panthers, you know, they're not a team that has a great downfield receiving core here. Is this a team they can generate offense against?
It can. Carolina's solution to that will probably be to keep extra guys in to help pass protect. They tend to go to those heavy protections, 6 and 7 man protections. They actually did that quite a bit against Arizona. The downside when you do that is you kind of remove McCaffrey from the equation, because often your running back is going to be one of those extra blockers there. And even if he's not, your routes are designed such that you don't really have, it's not as easy to just dump the ball off to your back when you don't have as many guys out in routes. But that's how they play. And there's benefits to it as well. And I would imagine that will be their approach initially, is we will not let JJ Watt wreck this game. We're gonna beat Houston downfield on their back end, and we're not gonna let them beat us up front. So 6 and 7 man protections, inherently you get some deeper throws off of that.
All right, Andy, I think it's time to open the mini mailbag here. Every week we will take at least 2 or 3 questions from the mini mailbag, and we're gonna answer them. We're not just gonna take them and read them to ourselves. If you have a question, just send it to talkback@themmqb.com. Put podcast somewhere in there. It helps, frankly, it helps me find them when I'm looking for them. You can get us on Twitter or Facebook as well, but really, TalkBack is the way to go. That's the most efficient way to get your question into us. But let's start here. This is from Dante. What are you guys' thoughts on Marcus Mariota and the offensive scheme that he has played in, and whether or not it matches his talent? Now, obviously, Andy, when Mariota was coming out, he was a Chip Kelly guy, and we all wondered, can the Eagles come up and get Mariota somehow at the top of the draft, et cetera, et cetera. He hasn't really played in, he hasn't played in an offense that necessarily fit what you saw from him at Oregon, right. I think is how I'd say it. I don't know if they've just found the right fit for him. And I guess at this point, you kind of wonder, does the right fit exist for him in the NFL?
Well, I think the right fit is what Dante is talking about. What got forgotten, and not even forgotten, it was overlooked from the start. When Mike Mularkey was there running the exotic smash mouth, as everyone called it, people talked about that and how there's smash mouth in the ball in an era when nobody does. The Titans had a drastically different offense when it was a 2-minute situation. It was like they were a whole different football team. They went to these spread sets, 3 receivers. I don't know if they put 4 receivers on the field. Delanie Walker probably serves as a 4th receiver. I think it was only 3, but they were running 4 receiver type concepts. It was closer to the Cliff Kingsbury stuff we're seeing in Arizona than it is a traditional NFL offense. And I thought Mariota looked really good in them. They had some of the best 2-minute statistics in the NFL that year. Mariota was very comfortable. I think that's his best system. Now, that might not be the best system for everyone else in the organization, the other players, the type of defense you have, what have you. But when they hired Mike Vrabel, his offensive coordinator was going to be Ryan Day. And that's Ohio State's guy. I don't follow college closely, but isn't Ryan Day, Gary, he's kind of one of those Chip Kelly types, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what they do up at Ohio State, yeah.
So that was the plan. And then Ryan Day, for whatever reason, didn't work out. He didn't take the job. And so Matt LaFleur got the job. And I'm almost positive that it was not Vrabel's call. It was someone else's call on the team, because LaFleur was someone they knew because he had interviewed for the job that they'd just given to Vrabel. Mm-hmm. They went with LaFleur, and they didn't want to change. He's there 1 year, and now he's in Green Bay, and they think, well, shoot, can we really ask Mariota to learn a new system again? What would that be, like 3-4 new systems in as many years for him? We can't do that. Let's promote Arthur Smith, who's a very good tight ends coach, by the way, and a guy that deserves a chance to be a coordinator. Let's promote Arthur Smith and see if we can build on what we did last year rather than starting new. Lost in all this, though, is that there has been an effort to play the Chip Kelly style with Mariota, and it just hasn't been able to quite stick, and it probably won't stick, and if it will, it's going to be with a different team sometime for him.
No. Next one's from Chris. Would you trade 2 number ones for Jalen Ramsey? It's funny. 3 years ago, you would have said, oh, no non-quarterback is worth 2 number ones. But we've seen, look at what Tunsil got. Look at what Khalil Mack got.
And it's worked out, at least for Mack. We weren't doing the podcast that week when the Tunsil trade went down. We never talked about it. Tunsil was over overpriced. Two first round, and he's a great, but I think he's a top five left tackle potentially if he isn't already. But two first round picks for a guy that you're going to have to also give a big second contract to in the near future. You're right. 3 years ago, I would have said, no, I'm not trading multiple first rounders. I'm a big proponent of trading first rounders because to me, when you do that, you're basically trading for a talent that you know will has not been a bust in the NFL. Jalen Ramsey has proven himself in the NFL. The best corner in this upcoming draft, let's say you get that with your first round pick, he's 50-50 if he's going to really work out and live up to that status. No matter how much of a can't miss you think he is, it's always 50-50. So I like the idea of trading it. Multiple first rounders, that gets a little bit tougher. I would have traded for Ramsey 2 or 3 years ago, knowing what I know now, because I could have him on his rookie deal. But trading for him now, when you still have to pay him big money soon, that's a lot to ask. What would you do?
If I were the Chiefs, if I were the Chiefs, I'd do it. If I were the Eagles, I'd seriously think about it. But I think when you get to January and you're the Chiefs and you're running out the guys that they're running out now, I think you would be kicking yourself if you didn't do everything you could to acquire this guy.
Well, what if I said to you? Two things. First of all, those teams both believe they're going to be drafting near the very end of the first round.
Yep.
So they probably view it as like you're giving up like 1.5 first rounders to some degree.
Yeah.
But what if I said to you, those are both cover three base teams first and foremost, which doesn't mean, you know, you're still playing man coverage largely outside, but it's not just pure ISO man-to-man, which it sounds like that's what Ramsey wishes he were playing in Jacksonville, and I understand that he'd be great at that. But you're not playing that kind of scheme. You're kind of zone-based a little bit, and your corners now, we're talking Kansas City mostly, they've been good. They have been. They're not great, and maybe not even quite good, but they've been serviceable. Breland's having a nice season, and I think that Tre'Davious Ward's a guy that they're higher on than people on the outside would be. So I say, okay, you're a zone defense, and you have good enough corners, average corners, not bad, average. Would you still do it for Ramsey?
Yes. Yeah, I think I would.
All right.
Well. I think they can. I think now is the time for them to strike. And I think on top of that, you know, the zone versus man stuff with Ramsey, I think that is a factor. I think that would really take care of itself. It wasn't an issue 2 years ago, at least until they lost the AFC title game. I don't think it's an issue if you're on a team that's going to go 13-3.
Well, remember when you and I spoke with AJ Bouye at the Super Bowl, I said, what are your patterns for how you travel with receivers? Because I can never tell how they're matching up in Jacksonville. Sometimes Ramsey's left corner, sometimes he's right corner, sometimes it's specific guys. And Bouye, in so many words, he didn't say it like this, but what I took from it, tell me if you agree, was, well, it's basically Jalen decides how we play and I do whatever is left over.
Yes, it was funny when I re-listened to that interview whenever we ran it in August on the cornerback show. I was like, "Oh wow, I didn't quite absorb it the same way that day as I did listening to it again." But yeah, I think that's exactly what he was saying.
So Ramsey, it's not like Ramsey's locked into a bag. He's not the new term now with the Minka Fitzpatrick trade, there we go, is anchored. Mike Tomlin said we're going to anchor him to one position. Everyone was using the word anchor last week. Ramsey is not anchored to one position in Jacksonville. He has a lot of freedom coverage-wise. He just doesn't get to make the calls, and I'm sure he wishes it was more pure man-to-man, but I don't know.
I think winning takes care of that. And if you're a team that plans on winning, I think that's a guy you go and get. We got time for one more question here, Andy. This is coming from Gary in Connecticut. What is the Clem fake?
The Clem fake.
K-L-E-M fake.
Yeah, K-L-E-M fake. Well, remember, Gary in Connecticut. I'll just answer to Gary. I have actually a podcast partner named Gary who lives in Connecticut. And after the Thursday night season opener, Packers, Bears, remember Robert Klemko on our staff wanted to know Aaron Rodgers, they had run a running play and Rodgers starts to hand off and then violently twists his body around and throws it outside. And Klemko's like, whoa, what is this new play? What is this exciting new play? And he was just gaga over it. And after the game, it was hours after, because I watched those games real late on DVR, I he had texted me, I texted him back, and Robert Klemko, he immediately texted back, and it was super long, and that he was so into this fake. So all it was is a smoke type of screen or some kind of RPO. It's almost certainly a smoke screen. They call a run play, and the quarterback decides, I think I can throw this and sneak one in there. But anytime I see these plays now with QBs throwing these quick backside slants, I think of Robert Klemko, and I've since taken to tweeting at him every time I see one, and it became the Klemko fake and then Klem fake.
So it's let me get this straight. It's kind of when it's an RPO type play, but really that there's no mesh point at any point.
It's in the quarterback's mind. It's an RPO. I have the run pass option. It's a run play that the quarterback decides to throw the ball on. And I'm sure that's built into the play design. Green Bay has done that a lot. Adam Gase has done that a lot over the years as well. Everybody does that to some degree. Green Bay does it more than anyone. What's different, a lot of times you see those on receiver screens. It's a run play and then you throw the screen. This is a run play and you throw a slant instead. And some of them have looked pretty weird and extreme because for whatever reason, there have been an unusual number this year where the receiver didn't read it the same way as the QB and the receiver is going to block. And so the throw looks like, what are you doing? You're throwing into the...
Yeah.
But I think that's what's going on. It's honestly, it's not any kind of big deal at all. Robert Klemko got really excited about it, though. And whenever someone gets excited about something like that for football, I can't help but get excited. So now I'm seeing Klem fakes across the league. Andy Dalton had one the other day.
Oh, there you go. I'll keep an eye out for him then. Andy, let's go to the lightning round. Let's wrap this thing up. We have, what do we have? We have 10 games left here to talk about for Sunday and of course the Monday nighter as well. We are starting with the Titans and Falcons. What's the issue with the Falcons offenses here?
Well, first of all, I love that we have the music under this. Isn't it more fun to listen to when the music is under this?
It's gotten some mixed feedback, but
has it? No,
I like it.
Real quick, and then we'll actually be lightning. Who complained?
Some people are complaining that the music distracts from our analysis.
All right, then we'll turn the music down just a little bit, starting now. We'll see if that works.
Right.
What's wrong with the Titans offense this year, or excuse me, the Falcons offense
with the
this
Falcons,
year?
With the Falcons offense.
Yeah, two guys that I don't think, and I'm not ready to declare it yet, so we're just floating the thesis out there right now. Two guys that don't quite look the same, Devontae Freeman and maybe Matt Ryan, and actually Alex Mack too. It's a pretty important group of players there for that offense.
Yeah. Browns at Ravens. Who do you feel better about long-term at this point, Baker Mayfield or Lamar Jackson?
It's a hard one because right now it's Lamar far and away. I am head over heels for Lamar Jackson. Baker Mayfield has a lot of attributes that have been proven to work in the NFL long-term. He's just not showing them right now. I think I might go Lamar still, Gary. The NFL is changing a little. The mobile QB, there's more room for him in the game now than there used to be. And Jackson's a pocket passer first before a mover.
Patriots at Bills. How does Sean McDermott's unit match up with this edition of the Patriots offense?
McDermott's units are always going to match up a little better than you expect because they're so good at identifying or figuring out your protections and then getting into defensive looks that kind of complicate that or even outright exploit it. I don't know if that'll be a huge deal in this game because you don't necessarily want to blitz Tom Brady, but let's put that as a starting place. Bills are going to know how to line up and then they're going to get into different coverages out of it. They play basic coverages, but they get to them in unusual ways sometimes. So I think they match up pretty well. I think New England's a better unit, and I expect them to win this game. But the Bills' defense, what this question's kind of asking under the surface, are the Bills for real? I think their defense is for real.
Chiefs at Lions. How's this Lions offense been different under Daryl Bevel?
More run-pass balance. We haven't seen as many of the Patriot tactics that I thought we'd see. We've seen some. The stack releases, the motions and switching. And Matt Patricia, I assume, wants to play that way. But it's Bevel hasn't fully dived into that, and that's really not been his forte over the years. What he's good at is establishing an outside zone running game and working the offense from there. And Detroit's off to a nice start with that.
Raiders at Colts. Oakland's offense has looked just not very good since that opening win over Denver. Is there anything they can do to get going, or is this a matter of they just don't have the weapons to do it?
Well, their offensive line has not been healthy yet, and that's been a little bit of a factor. Gabe Jackson, when he gets back at right guard, that it's not going to change everything, but that might get him going in the right direction a little bit.
Chargers at Dolphins. What's going on with the Chargers and their sort of super Keenan Allen-centric offense at this point, especially over the last 2 weeks, and they're not quite putting up the points you'd like to see?
They're not. They've had some turnovers down in the red zone, so they're moving the ball. They look the same that they've normally looked. I think the Keenan Allen thing is just kind of a coincidence. He is a great, great player, and it's a great player putting up big numbers, and I don't think the offense is it's probably dependent on him, but it's not solely dependent on him. Mike Williams has been a weapon. Rivers knows how to get the ball to his ancillary weapons underneath when it calls for that. It's not a deep passing game, but I'm not as worried about that. One thing that you do worry about a little bit, the inconsistency along their offensive line. Dan Feeney at guard, Schofield at the other guard, he's the right guard. Some weeks they look just fine. Feeney's athletic even. Other weeks they look like they did against the Ravens in week 14 last year, where they get humiliated by pass rushers. So inconsistency along the offensive line. It's not a great old line overall.
Shaq Barrett, this would be the Bucs at Rams. Shaq Barrett has 8 sacks, leads the NFL. Is this for real, Andy?
His 8 sacks have been for real, and he's had a lot more plays than just those 8 as well. Sometimes sacks can kind of pile up, and it's the way it goes, and hey, you got some good numbers there. These are legitimate, full-fledged, difference-making sacks. He's also doing it against the run. He's going outside. He's going inside. He has a great spin move. He's bendable. He plays stronger than he is because he's a leverage guy. Shaq Barrett has been absolutely sensational so far. The numbers are real because the films look that good. I don't know if it'll continue like that, but what he's done has been outstanding.
Seahawks at Cardinals. How does the Seahawks cover 3 matchup with Cliff Kingsbury's air raid offense, or are we going to see more Seattle man coverage?
That's a great one. I'm eager to see how that goes. I would, if I'm Seattle, I think I'd go man-to-man. Ultimately, the air raid stuff that Kingsbury is doing, it's interesting. I don't think it's going to hold up in and of itself. I think they need to add more to the running game eventually, and some of the misdirection and screens that they're doing, they need to expand that or solidify that, because right now it's an offense that lines up and just throws fast a lot, quick throws out of fast formations. But you need receivers who can win one-on-one in order to do that. These receivers really aren't great. Christian Kirk gets treated as their number one. He's not a number one. Fitzgerald's their best player, but he doesn't scare you with the way he runs anymore, and that's really all they have. So I think they're going to have to do some adjusting. Seattle, if I'm them, I just go man-to-man and make them try to beat us.
Jaguars at Broncos. This is Shaq Barrett's old team. The Broncos have 0 sacks and 0 takeaways through 3 games. Is there something wrong here, or is this just one of those fluky bad luck type of things?
I just got done watching the Broncos film right before we recorded here, and I wrote at the end, and it's, you kind of notice at the end, I go, hey, you, Bradley Chubb, Von Miller, we didn't see a whole lot from them. You kind of, you don't want to say you forget they're out there, but they were not huge factors in the game, and I've written that a couple of times now. Now, I've also written that we've seen some offenses adjust to take those guys out of the game as well, so it's a little bit of both. I would imagine the Jags, I bet you they adjust as well and go with a lot of wing tight. They've done this before. This is the previous regime. It wasn't DeFilippo, but it was under Doug Marrone. One thing they might do is go with wing tight ends, and you get chip blocks inherently on each play. A lot of the plays they were running with Gardner Minshew were those type of high-low routes, where a wing tight end can just be the underneath route and someone goes on a deep corner and you high-low a defender. I bet they'll see a lot of that, and maybe it's a quiet game again for Chubb and Miller. That's your best bet. I wouldn't worry too much about it if I'm Denver fans.
And Monday Night Football, Bengals at Steelers. You know, Bengals have been close. They almost won in Seattle. They almost won in Buffalo. What's your take on the Zach Taylor offense, especially without A.J. Green 3 games into his tenure?
It's a very well-schemed offense. One of the more intriguing schemes in the NFL. The route combinations are excellent, similar to what you see from Washington a little bit. They have a lot of answers. The stuff they've done that's creative has worked tactically. We said earlier, though, coaches are still on the sidelines ultimately. The players are the ones on the field. You got to have the players. They are overwhelmingly deficient along the offensive line. They have no running game whatsoever because of that. And their receivers really aren't very good with AJ Green out. And you see some of the imprecision in those well-designed plays. So great design, poor execution right now. That's not all on the players either. Zach Taylor, look, they got to coach and teach these guys. So you got to go out there with the guys you have. But it's a good offense, just in a tough spot personnel-wise.
All right. Just like that, the lightning round is over.
That was all right. I think we did lightning. We were pretty lightning there.
It slogged a little bit. I mean, it was all good information. Slog isn't the right word, but it...
No, that's a hurtful word.
It was. It really was. I apologize for that. But yeah, we got through it.
I'll be quicker.
It was all good.
I'll be quicker next week.
It was all gold. It was good. All right, that's going to be a wrap for this week's show. The MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast is Andy Benoit and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is executive director of the MMQB. Research help from Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.